absolutely. Welcome along. I'm Ian Gardner. I'm your host this morning. We used to hold our events here with Gilbert and Tobin a couple of years ago, literally in this office as it was set up for Gilbert and Tobin. So it is kind of weird coming home. Probably a bit weird for you as well, Deborah. You upgraded apparently to Barangaroo. So there's quite a few new faces. Who's never been to one of these before? All right, well, welcome along. Maybe I should just explain why we do this. So Innovation Bay was founded by me and Faden. Where's Faden? Hello, buddy. 14, 15 years ago. So our objective at Innovation Bay is to help technology entrepreneurs be more successful. So most of you here are either tech entrepreneurs, investors, or people in the community supporting one of them. And if you're not one of those people, you're probably at the wrong event. So we do it really just to help them. And it's much better than it used to be in the ecosystem. We see our view as just helping to nurture that and make it better for everyone all around. So we want to see thousands of new startups and support them the best we can. We do this because of some sponsors, so I want to call them out. So Deloitte, Macquarie, and Gilbert and Tobin. So thank you, everyone from there. Let me just make sure I've got everything. So this is Paul. We're going to have a chat with Paul. So just to explain the format, Paul and I will have a chat for, I don't know, probably 30, 40 minutes, and then we'll throw it to you guys for Q&A. So think of your questions on the way through. We are recording this. So we just launched a new podcast. So if anyone wants to check it out, Open the Pod Bay Doors was launched in that, like, yeah. People, I think it's quite a cool name. Like, does people get the reference? You know, 2001 Space Odyssey, evil computer killing humans. Yeah, anyway. Right, should we get on with this?
Sure.
Yeah?
What does it mean, though? What, open the pod date? Like, I know the movie, but in what reference to...
I know, you're asking... I'm asking the difficult questions, really? Paul, yeah.
My goal is just to keep flipping questions back to you.
Well, maybe just start... you know, I sometimes do these with a more standard format, so just get a bit of context to you, how your career started, how you got into superannuation, and how it's going now. So why don't we start at the beginning? So you just said you're from Liverpool. So tell us about where you're from and how you came to Australia.
So I grew up in Queensland. I had a slightly different route to most people in that I opened a computer store, you know, for 2-3 years before I actually had a real career. So I did a bachelor of business, opened a computer store, did that for a little bit.
This was in Liverpool?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Just checking.
But the reason... It was wonderful because I was actually working part-time in a computer store in my last year of university. And then, you know, I figured I can do this. So I opened up a store and it was good because it was actually like a little mini business, you know, and you could actually kind of, you know, have customers, make a little bit of money each week and then start working out what to do with that money. And you sort of say, well, do I expand the computer store? Do I open new locations? Do I take the money out and kind of invest it? And that kind of investor mindset or operator mindset I've always kind of had. So I did that for a bit and then I went to Goldman's, did Goldman's for 5 years.
In London?
In Sydney.
Okay. So how did you get from Liverpool to Sydney?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
I don't mean physically. I suspect you took a plane, but...
You've extended the joke so far, I can't come back from it. Goldman's was wonderful in that, you know, you actually work 80, you know, 100 hours a week. Like, it was really kind of, I was 24, 25 when I first went there. It almost killed me, if I'm being honest. But I did it for 5 years, and then I was lucky enough to come across a family office that just sold a very large business. You know, they sold it for $600 million. Their take of it was $400 million. They hired me and a CFO to kind of help them build the investment and compliance infrastructure around the family office. So you had an entrepreneur who was 64, and then you had four children who were in their 40s. And so I had this wonderful thing where I could run around to all the other family offices in Australia and see, well, what do you insource, what do you outsource? And then how do you kind of set that up? And then we started actually investing the capital.
Just to sound check, how are you guys at the back? Do we need a mic? Right.
I'll talk louder.
No, we've got our Maxims back, so we can fix it up.
How's that?
All right.
I don't actually have a radio voice, so that's why I hate talking to
a microphone. I've got a face for radio.
I did that for a few years, and then I met your first guest, Daniel Petrie and Craig Blair, on your first podcast. And they were just starting AirTree Ventures as a business. And Deborah was doing a little legal work on it from G&T. And that was a phenomenal experience. You know, what was interesting, I didn't know Daniel before going into the first meeting I had with him. And I sat down with him and he was, he was trying to get, something working on his computer. And I made a joke about, it's Microsoft, it's a terrible product. And he goes, well, you know, funny you should say that. And I just sat in my chair and just shrunk down for the rest of the meeting. So,
for those of you that don't know, Daniel used to run the Office component for Microsoft back in the early 2000s.
That's probably the stupidest thing I could have said. So do your research before you meet anyone. So.
All right, so that's, in many ways, for someone in your position, getting a venture partner position at Airtree is the dream job. So the call of the wild, as I call it, must have been pretty strong for you to leave someone like that. So tell us about that call of the wild. What made you want to leave a gig like that?
I think being a venture capitalist is absolutely the best job you can get. There's nothing better because you hang out with the probably the weirdest people in the world who are just so intelligent and so different to what you come across within corporates. We did Airtree Fund 1, it was a $60 million fund. We found 20-odd businesses to invest in. But the whole time you're kind of watching it from the sidelines, it's kind of like watching football, and you just want to, I want to play. And that was always kind of in me because I'd done the computer store and, tried some other stuff as well. And superannuation really kind of was such a wonderful blend between having an investment mindset and then also starting a business. So I just got to the point where I wanted to jump.
But superannuation, even the word is boring. why superannuation?
I think it's fascinating because as an investor, you're trying to understand the world, right? That's the critical thing you're trying to do as an investor. You're trying to understand the world better than anyone else and then, allocate capital based on that. Within superannuation, it's the only place where you truly have to think about what the world will look like 30 years from now. So I'm 35. You can't liquidate your superannuation until you're 65. So it's literally you have to invest over the very, very long term, and nowhere else can you really do that. If you look at the average hold period of stocks back in the 50s and 60s, it was 7 years, and now it's 7 months. So everything about the world has gone to the short term and not the long term, but only in this weird, obscure thing called superannuation does it have to remain in not just the long term, but the very, very long term. And I think that's probably the most interesting place to invest.
So can you give us some macro context for it? So, it's 9.5% of all income goes to super. So how big is it? How's that relative to the rest of the world? It's huge.
So I think it's the third or fourth biggest pension market in the world. There's $2.3 trillion of superannuation now. That's doubled in the last 10 years. It's going to double again in the next 10 years. It's 9.5% of our income. So if if your salary is $1,000 a week, everyone's literally sending $100 to someone somewhere to do something with. You probably haven't heard from that guy, it is a very large market, and also it's a very fragmented market. So people think that the super funds are very, very large, but they're actually very, very small. So the largest super fund has less than 5% market share, and the top 20 funds have less than 40% market share. So that's a very fragmented market. It's not like the big four banks where there's four of them.
So that 2.3 trillion Aussie dollars?
Yes.
What's that invested in? So where is that currently sitting?
So it's mostly Aussie stocks. I'll get the number wrong, but it's something like 30 to 40% in Australian businesses. That probably doesn't make sense if you think about, on a global scale, we have 3% of the world equities, right? So what you're saying, if you're going to have an overweight position in that country's businesses, you should probably have a reason for having that view. So, we have some customers who come to Australia on a visa or whatever, and they start earning salary here, and they'll talk to me and they'll say, I'm from Brazil. Why do I have to own your country's businesses? Why should I own Brazilian businesses and then US businesses? So That always confused me. No one's ever really given me a good answer as to why, when everything's global in nature these days, even the customer bases. So if you look at the, you know, ANZ, for instance, it has customers in New Zealand and Southeast Asia. They're investing over there. Everyone's thinking on a global scale. But when we think about our retirement portfolio for the next 30 years, we generally have this concentration in local businesses.
And that concentration, I mean, I'm not sure, someone could fact check me if I'm wrong here, but the overall market cap of the whole ASX is what? Is it 3 trillion?
Oh.
Does anyone know?
Yeah, I had that number
before. Fact check and shout out.
It's pretty close to the size of the superannuation market, if I recall. So, and if you look at the index, it's something like, I think it's 30% in financials, 15% in property, and 15% in commodities. You know, so it's somewhere in that, and that's probably probably the least diversified index you could probably come across. If you really
yeah, and you know, I've talked about this before, but the top four ASX companies are banks.
Yeah,
which is a third of the value, and I think that's unique in the world.
Totally.
And then half the value is in the top 10 stocks, which again is pretty unique in the world.
Well, think of it like this. The big four banks are worth about $425 billion today. Facebook in US dollars, not Aussie dollars, is worth about the same, right? And Facebook's the most covered, talked about company globally. So every day there's a news article about Facebook, right? And you think there's this little country with 20 million people and their banks are worth as much as, you know, the most important, probably the most important company in the world. That's bananas.
I mean, there's a stat that, yeah, it is. So if you take Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, and the other one.
I don't know, I wasn't listening.
Oh, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft. Who am I missing in the top five? Apple. Yeah, how did I forget that? Their market cap is more than twice the entire ASX. That's five companies.
That's crazy.
So now, I'm kind of coming on to, I think, what your thesis is around why, I mean, you know, I think you sometimes reference Wayne Gretzky, the ice hockey player, go to where the puck is going, not where it is now.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
Well, I think people don't think through what superannuation is. So our average customer has, call it $20,000 worth of super today, and each and every year for the rest of their career, they're going to allocate more money to that $20,000. So, you know, it's $20,000 this year, another $5,000 next year, et cetera, for the next 30 years. And what people are saying is, how do you build wealth? Well, one way is to, you could put that $20,000 into a lending account and lend it to someone. You could lend it to a bank, or you could lend it to, you know, other folks. Or you can invest it in a business. Now, there's some not great businesses like a cafe. You could buy, you know, a portion of a cafe and hold onto that cafe for the next 30 years. Or you could buy a small parcel of a number of businesses. And really, I think most people agree that the best way to kind of build wealth is to invest in businesses. And the question is, well, then which businesses? Now, some folks say you should just own the 500 largest businesses, right? And that's an index investor. You should just buy the index. Another person may say, well, hang on, maybe you should think through, well, which of those largest businesses will still be around 30 years from now? Where will the world be in 30 years? You know, and we really think that you could probably think through it a little bit more and go, which businesses do I want to own and allocate through business cycles? So what superannuation is not is trading through a business cycle. We're not trying to create alpha for customers or anything like that. You're not trying to, I'm going to buy Amazon this year and then 2 years later I'm going to sell out of Amazon. That doesn't really make sense on a 30-year time horizon. That's really hard to do. But if you can identify businesses that are highly differentiated and highly defensible, you really do want to average into them over a long period of time. If you look at, you know, the most wonderful businesses from the last century, whether it's Walmart, McDonald's, or Coca-Cola, all those, you could probably identify in the 60s that Coca-Cola was a really good business. And if you knew for the next 30 years you'd be having to send money to some sort of business, you could probably get your head around having 1% of your retirement portfolio in, say, Coca-Cola. In the same way that in Spaceship's current GrowthX portfolio, you can have, I think it's 2.7% in Google, for instance.
Okay, so look, can you tell us how it works then? So let's pretend for a sec that I'm 25, I wish.
I'll pretend as well.
It's not funny. I make the jokes here. And, you know, I've got a decent income, not thinking about super. see an advert for Spaceship or see you come to one of the events that you seem to talk at all the time.
Tonight as well.
Tonight too, really? Yeah. Wow. So how does it work? So what's your thesis or what's your value proposition to me? Why would I invest my super with you? What do you do that others don't?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things to unpack. I traditionally come from a wholesale investing environment, and what really blew me away when you come to a retail investing environment such as superannuation is you're not really treated as a wholesale customer. You know, when we were at Airtree with our investors, we would have to kind of tell them what's going on every month. You know, what the hell you guys been doing? You know, what's your view? You know, Trump's come into power in America. What does that mean for our portfolio? You know. So even just investing communications is not there in superannuation. So there's this joke that one of our early customers said it. He said, I hear from my electricity company four times a year. That's more than my superannuation company. That doesn't make much sense, you know. At the very least, you should know what's going on with your portfolio and why someone's made those decisions. A lot of people kind of want to say, oh, Spaceship's disrupting super. We're not really. Disruption is a kind of, it sounds like we're a loud kid in the corner, you know, wrecking a party or something. Superannuation has actually been probably the best innovation in financial services on a global scale, the last 20 or 30 years. If you look at Supermatch version 2 that came out last year, that is absolutely the best piece of innovation that's happened in financial services in this country in the last decade. So all we're doing is kind of extending what's been done very, very well in superannuation. But what hasn't been done that well is helping people engage and make an active decision around this retirement portfolio they have. So,
okay. Let's pretend again that I'm now 35, mm-hmm. still not quite there, and I got 100 grand of super. So how much granularity over my super pot do I have with Spaceship? So can I decide where it goes?
Yeah, so the first part of that is if you look at what the industry has done historically is they've outsourced investment management. So if you try and unpick where your capital is, it's very, very difficult. You can't work out what your top 10 holdings are. And I think that's crazy. If you're trying to rely on this portfolio to retire with, you kind of want to know, well, what are the top 10 companies I'm relying on to grow over the next 30 years? So with Spaceship, we have 100% transparency as to what companies you're invested in. So you can log into our member portal and see, hey, I've got, $2,700 in Google. And that's a non-trivial, non-obvious, difference because for a young person, they don't identify with $20,000 in a member account that they get an annual statement from, but they do identify with an ability to click on their phone and see, wow, I've got $2,700 in Google. That's really cool. You know, I love that company. That's really cool.
Okay. So can you tell us, how did you join Spaceship? Because Spaceship existed before you came along. So can you tell us that story?
Not really. So there's a couple of guys who are really kind of working on it for a period of time. And I went through a transition period from Airtree. So it took, I think, 3 months to kind of make the decision and then transition from my role there. So Kaushik, who's my co-founder, who we kind of he's the COO, I'm the CEO. He had been in superannuation for the last 10 years, and over the last few years we had gotten to know each other more and more, and just had longer and longer discussions about what was happening in superannuation. He was the ATO rep for the Supermatch version 2 thing and all sort of stuff. So he had done a lot of stuff, but he was increasingly frustrated with the fact that young people weren't engaging with super, which kind of sucks. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I was learning more and more about superannuation in the context of my wholesale investing environment and going, well, this doesn't make sense. So the more I learned about it, the more I saw an opportunity to kind of do something that would help a lot of people. So,
and this was, a year and a half? How long ago was this? It was pretty recent.
Yeah, it was June last year, June. So we raised our seed round in July from Mike Cannon-Brookes and a whole bunch of, well, pretty much, the most successful people in tech in Australia have invested in our seed round. We probably didn't raise enough money at the time, reflecting on it. starting an APRA regulated entity is not like a SaaS business, so.
But it's hard when you're raising money and you're small with no traction because you're giving away huge amounts of the company.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we didn't have a product. We built a slide deck, but we never presented it to anyone. So, but what we did do is we understood we unpicked the product more than anyone else. So we knew more about superannuation than anyone. And we had a unique view as to where we saw superannuation going.
Okay, so fast forward 12 months, and we're here. That's about right, isn't it?
10 months.
10 months. Wow. So, I mean, I know you don't disclose all your numbers, but, I mean, what numbers can you disclose? I heard you've got 16 staff. That's probably one that we can...
Yeah. So, if you visit us in January, February, when so the story was we raised $1 million in July last year. We spent 6 months kind of going through a regulatory process. That was really hard because we're the kind of first, kids out of the block doing that. There's some other new super funds that are coming out now. And really kind of we feel like we were the eldest child in a family where we kind of got in trouble and paved the way for them. So the risk that the license holders would take on when we were first going to market was a lot less than what they're willing to take on now because no one believed that we could build a customer base very, very quickly. So, disclosing numbers, we got to 100 million very, very quickly of funds under management. That's growing, more than $1 million a day at this point.
So, and that's active. So you're actively investing this money now?
Yeah. So we've, since inception, the portfolio is up 7.7%. As of today, the industry benchmark, Jordan's got the numbers, but I think it's 2.8% is what the numbers are. The biggest growth, high growth portfolio as a competitor is up 5.8%. Now, the short-term numbers are pretty meaningless, but that's a nice kind of start for us.
And you've raised some money recently. I mean, how much can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we're trying to keep it a secret, to be honest.
You didn't do a super job of that.
we try really, really hard, and it just became harder and harder because Koshik and I were on planes, and people asking, "Where are you?" And I'm like, "I don't know." So we're very fortunate, very, very lucky. We raised $19.5 million from probably the hardest investment committees to get through in the world. So New Enterprise Associates, one of Peter Thiel's venture arms, Sequoia, Horizon Ventures, which is a big VC fund as well, and then locally as well.
Is Horizon, is that Li Ka-shing?
Yeah. So he's the richest person in Southeast Asia. They've done incredible things. They did the Series C of Facebook. They did the Series B of Airbnb, all sorts of things. So.
And you got some money from Airtree as well?
Airtree,
so what was it like being on the other side of the table?
No, it was really, really, really good. I learned so much from Craig and Daniel, and you don't realize it until you have time away, and then you start applying what you're learning. Do you know what I mean? And then you come back, and you sit back down with them. It was such a wonderful experience to go, hey, mom and dad, this is what I've been doing. And now, because those guys are invested, I talk to Daniel every week now. So it's just nice to have that, back in my career, which is nice.
So, but how do you manage your time? I mean, it's maybe a lesson for everyone here. I mean, I often say to people, raising money for a business is a full-time job. Running the business is a full-time job. Marketing the business in the way that you seem to be out and about everywhere is a full-time job. So you've got three full-time jobs.
Yeah.
How are you doing this?
It's very, very difficult. I look tired. So for our first 2 months, we onboarded every single customer with a phone call. So we were calling up customers from literally 8 o'clock in the morning till about 8, 9 o'clock at night.
And these are just like people. These
aren't real people. Companies. Yeah. Not bots or anything. But people really appreciate that because you pick up the phone and you just say, hey, thanks so much for your interest and support in what we're doing at Spaceship. And then you gives them an opportunity just to see there's a real person at the other end of the phone. We did it on Saturdays too, 9 till 5. I've had some funny conversations with people within the ecosystem. They didn't expect me to call them up at on a Saturday, so that was fun. So, but your original question was, how do you do it? It's very, very difficult. I think one thing I learned from Craig at Airtree is how do you set the priority for what you're working on? And you, within a startup, you're burning a lot of money each and every day. So you're really kind of trying to work out what is the one thing that's going to push the business forward. And unfortunately, that's at the detriment of everything else. So you've got to kind of purposely let things fall to the wayside. And so when I think about the year so far, the first 2 months was really kind of trying to get the customer base up and running. And then the following 2 months was jumping on planes, trying to talk to these investment committees. Now it's trying to get a team in place. So we went from sort of 6 people to 16 people now. We've got another 3 people starting in the next 4 weeks. We'll get to 25 people hopefully by the end of Q3. You've got to do that well. You're trying to find very talented people who are sort of who you can unleash within superannuation.
That's another full-time job. It's, the CEO, you're responsible for the culture.
Totally.
So how are you doing that while you're recruiting so fast?
So what we do is we look for, so we assume capability. So we just assume that everyone is capable. So if we're hiring an engineer, we just assume that they have a level of capability and the signals that you can use for, where they've been before or whatever. But what we're really looking for is edge. So we're looking for people who have had, how do you get edge? Well, you've had something terrible happen to you, or you've had some wonderful experience, you've worked overseas or something like that, or you're deeply, deeply interested in something that's not your career. And the reason we look for those three things is it generally bleeds into your product. So, you can get an engineer who's capable, but if you get an engineer who's capable and has edge, it just comes out in your product in such wonderful ways. So I run around and try and find folks like that. And that's fun to do. And I'm pretty good at that because I was doing it. It's not dissimilar to trying to find amazing founders. You're looking for people who are sort of a little bit different. So,
and have you got a defined set of cultural values with that? I mean, have you written them down? And
yeah, well, we're doing a whole bunch of documentation from a regulatory standpoint, but at the same time, we're building out this handbook where we're writing that stuff down. But the testament to that, I would say, is talk to anyone in our team, and you'd be surprised if they all didn't say similar things as to what we care about, how we work and all sort of stuff. So,
I think the hard bit comes when you start getting from that 25 to 100 people and get management layers in, and especially at that pace of growth. How are you going to deal with that?
Yeah, well, I went through a difficult period where I went from having 10 direct reports to now having sort of 5 or 6 people. And it's kind of a bit sad because the early folks who join the team, I don't get to talk to them as much. You just can't. It's just too hard. So, and then you have someone in between them and you, and that's a bit of an adolescence that we're going through at this point. So,
okay, I'll maybe ask one or two more, and then we'll throw to the floor for questions. So, I mean, this might be a bit more of a boring one, but how hard was the compliance regime for you to to get your certificates and things to become a super fund?
It's really difficult. We're going through a set of product changes right now. And based on the level of funding that we brought into the business, we can kind of expand our investment options. Our fees are coming down. And we're doing a whole bunch of cool stuff around that. But, everything's just kind of slow and for the right reason, because it's people's retirements, money. You don't want to kind of do anything kind of too quickly. So it was just a long period. It took us 6 months to, 6 months in a room to get to market. So we didn't get to market till January of this year. Whereas with a SaaS product, you can probably spin something up in a weekend. So,
and is one of your team just focused on that? Have you got in-house lawyers?
Yeah, so we hired an extremely amazing executive called Michelle Moffat. She was the head of internal audit at Tyro for the last 7 years. So she was really in charge of not just understanding their compliance infrastructure, but really kind of making sure that it was in check. They went through a banking license through the Apple entity. So she's an amazing person to have on board. Before that, I think she spent 10 years at PwC in an auditing function as well. So,
okay. Well, and maybe the last question from me, what's next? I mean, you've done quite a lot in 1 year, 3 years, 5 year, 10 year horizon. Where are you going to be?
So we're just building more stuff for our customers. So our thesis for Spaceship is that, people really need help building savings and investments over their lives. And that just doesn't sit within compulsory savings. It also sits within discretionary savings. It doesn't make sense to me that you should have a brokerage button, you should have a discretionary portfolio button, you should have a savings button, you should have a superannuation button on your phone. You should probably just have one savings and investment button, preferably a spaceship button. So we're building out, you know, tools and products that are helpful to our customers. And the reason we're building them out is our customers are asking for them. You know, we have customers who say, I really like what you're doing in Super. I have $10,000 in a savings account. I don't know how to invest it. I don't know what to do with it. Can you help me with that? Or can you point me in the direction of someone who can? So our product roadmap is really married to what our customers are asking for. So over the next 6 to 12 months, you're going to see us be building that out.
Okay, I lied. I've got one more question. The early stage in investment, so venture or even seed, are you ever going to get into that?
Yeah, so if you look at superannuation funds, they generally have 10 to 20% in alternative assets. So if you look at, we have more than 100 million fund now, so there's 10 to 20 million or more of funds that need to find a way into alternative assets. Then you ask yourself, how do you mechanize that? So historically, super funds invest that in toll roads or direct property or VC funds or PE funds. What we're trying to do for our customers is to buy them very small ownership stakes in large private technology companies. So that would be, your Airbnbs, your Spotify's or whatever it is. And through the relationships we have through our cap table, we've been able to, find those names. And we're just going through a process of, setting the infrastructure up to be able to do that. That's taking longer than what I initially hoped it would take.
But you can't see yourself going even further.
I think within a retirement portfolio, what type of risk do you want to be taking on? You probably shouldn't be taking on, product market fit risk. You should be really just taking on, growth risk, right? So I don't think you should be investing in a less than $1 billion valued business. I think you're looking for a business that's proven that it's highly differentiated, that it has some form of defensibility either there now or it's being formed over time. And then you want the capacity to kind of average into that over time. What's happened? I mean, it's a well-known story that private companies are staying private for much longer. And the sad thing about that is that generally, private companies, their cap tables are made up of more wholesale investors than retail investors. So a lot of that wealth is not getting to a retail market.
It would also make it hard for you because there's no liquidity. I mean, if you invested in Uber or Airbnb, it's not that you can get your money out.
Yeah, but in superannuation, we don't really want liquidity.
Okay.
At all? No, we don't.
Well, eventually, surely.
30 years from now, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but you can't eat Uber shares.
No, you can't. Yeah, you can't eat Walmart shares either.
But you can sell them.
Yeah, no, I think the problem people have with superannuation is you're a net buyer of securities for the next 30 years, right? So people, if you really unpack that sentence, you realize that that changes how you mechanize your portfolio. A lot of people talk about, worrying about declining prices or what happens to tech and all this sort of stuff. But if you really think that through, you'll see that, if I got $20,000 now of super and I'm 25, I've got another 30 years of income going towards that. I'm actually buying more than I'm selling for the next 30 years. So what do you want? Well, you probably want lower valuation multiples and higher valuation multiples. So, if the market continues going up, that's actually probably not a good thing, and if you just roll it back to, any time I think about investing, I always put the analogy of the cafe, in that if you think about a cafe that costs $1 million to buy and there's an income stream of, say, $50,000 a year coming from it, so dividends, what do you want to do? If you've got to buy that same cafe every year for the next 30 years, $1 million this year, $1 million next year, do you want $1 million to be $1 million or do you want it to be 500,000? Well, of course, So if people think of it from a whole business standpoint, they usually remove this kind of ticker mentality of Bloomberg and CNBC and all this sort of stuff that people do when they think about investments.
Okay, well, should we take some questions from the floor? Who's going to be first? Yeah.
How do you weight your portfolio across the different asset classes? What proportion is tech? And do you have a team that analyzes which stocks or which shares you have a preference for, and therefore monitor how the shares are going and whether there's been a change?
Totally. So we have three people, three investment professionals in the team at this point. We're hiring more. So if you know anyone who's interested, I'd love to talk to them. So that team, you know, looks through the portfolio, and we've built the portfolio as it stands today. There's a 35% tech core to the portfolio, and then it's diversified around that. So we don't think that you should own 30 tech companies and that's it. We think you should own 30 tech companies within a diversified portfolio. We think you should be overweight technology companies only because technology companies are really the most wonderful companies in the world at this point, in the fact that they're the most differentiated, defensible businesses. If we were sitting in the 60s, we would probably be, you know, trying to align ourselves to the wonderful consumer brands that were being built at that time, which is McDonald's, Walmart, or whatever it is. But in this day and age, technology is really being the enabler and differentiator for all companies, whether you're Domino's Pizza or whether you're Facebook. So we think you should have that lens if you're thinking through what does the world look like over the next 30 years. So that's how we kind of think through. I don't know whether I answered your question or not.
And so you're sort of looking through the cycle. So a lot of fund managers try to play the cycle.
Totally.
Cash.
Yeah, totally.
And so you're looking right through it, saying the long term.
Totally, yeah.
That's going to be a...
Totally, yeah. I think what you want to do is it takes a very long time to understand a business and understand that it's differentiated and defensible. And once you do, then you want an ability to allocate to that business, buy more of that business over business cycles rather than just trying to time a market. I don't think you can kind of sit there and go, Amazon's a wonderful business today. I'm going to sell out of it 2 years from now and then buy back into it 3 years later. I think that's probably not what you want to do. Most active fund managers are trying to do that. They're trying to create a thing called alpha through a business cycle. I don't think that's what you should do in superannuation, nor do you have to. The other thing I would say is that superannuation is actually a savings and investment product. It's not just an investment product. Most people don't realize that, you know, if you talk to any of our customers, the biggest frustration is they have no idea how much they need to have when they're 65 years old. You know, do I need $2 million, $3 million, or $4 million? What's the number? And if you don't know that number, then how can you know whether the number that you're saving this year is appropriate for, you know, where you're going to be 30 years from now? And how do you know what you're assuming for a market return? So, you know, Ian may be more aggressive than me. He may assume a 4% market return, but I only want to assume a 2% market return. So for me, I need to save more than you to get to where I need to be. But right now, there's no sort of product experience where you can kind of easily log into something and go, okay, I need to save not 9.5% of my income. I need to save 12.5% of my income. So I think what we're trying to do is help people make an active decision around what they're doing with their retirement portfolio. So you can sit there and not wake up in your 50s and go, oh, shit, you know, I need to really save now. So.
All right, let's take, there's heaps of questions. Let's go Rich and then Charles.
What would be, for your business and then the wider superannuation industry, what would be a couple of the biggest misconceptions out there which you're having a hard time trying to educate people about?
For me,
I
think disrupting super is probably one that I get the most. I really don't think that we're disrupting super. I think that superannuation has gone from historically being an offline business, right? Like most industries, you know, you acquired a customer and you built a customer relation offline, and now it's moving online. Like everything else. So every business is trying to think through how do you build a relationship with a customer online. What we're trying to do within superannuation is help young people be engaged with it. I think that everyone would agree that young people have really not been well served with wealth management products because they're not valuable enough. You know, I think some of the stats we have, which just blows me away, is that, you know, we'll have balances where someone will have $10,000 balance And I have it across three funds. So the majority of customers who come across to us, they have more than two funds, right? So you just think that through. So if you have three funds, say a $2,000 balance, a $5,000 balance, a $3,000 balance, you're getting charged some sort of 1% asset management fee, and then you're getting charged a fixed fee, a fixed administration fee. The fixed administration fee is usually about $100 per fund. So if you have $10,000 across three funds, you have $300 of fixed fee and then a 1% fee or whatever it is. So you're paying $400 a year to manage that money. So that's a 4% fee. And then the other thing that happens, they usually default you into life insurance. So we have 22% of the Supermatch searches that we've done. So 22% of the customers that have come across have, I think it's more than two or three life insurance policies. So it's like, what are they, cats? What are they trying to do? You know, so... And they're like 25 years old and they have no dependents. They don't have a partner or whatever. So there's no, it's obviously a decision for them to make, but it probably doesn't make sense for them to have life insurance at that point in their life. So life insurance, how much does that cost? Well, it can cost anywhere from $200 to $500 a year in premiums coming out of your super. So you're getting charged $400 for your 10 grand plus two to three insurance policies at $300 a pop. So you're being charged 10% this year to build wealth. That's a disaster. That's bananas, right? So, and when you talk to young people and you frame it in a different way, if you say, well, I have a $100,000 salary, if I give you $9,500 to buy a car with, which is what you're sending to a superannuation fund manager, if I say to all young people, here's $9,500, go buy a car. They get really excited. They're like, oh, this is awesome. I'll go to car yards. I'll do some research online. I'll talk to my friends. I'll talk about it on a Friday night at the pub. But yet that same purchasing decision that everyone in this room is making each and every month, no one thinks about. So we're trying to help people at least make an active decision in wealth.
Okay, we've got quite a few more questions, so let's just pick up pace. Charles, did you have one?
Yeah. Yep. The two things I look for when I'm investing in different funds that are out there are reporting, what kind of reporting you get, frustration, and fees, which is the second frustration. If you're differentiating yourself in that marketplace, how do you do better on those two things?
So I think that our reporting is going to be better than. Well, I hope so. We communicate with our customers every Thursday. So we send them an email every Thursday to tell them what we're up to, what we're doing. And our member portal is getting way better as far as reporting is concerned around performance and what's going on. There's full transparency in what we're invested in. On the fee things, our fees are too high at this point. They're coming down. I think if you're a subscale fund, it's difficult to run your operation without a higher fee. I mean, that just makes sense. If you're a corner store versus Woolworths, it's harder to kind of price yourself. Those fees are coming down. We've brought this capital in the business so we can bring them down quite a bit. There was another new super fund that came out with a 1.85% fee that's just launched this month. So it's not something that we did different to anyone else. It's just what you have to do within the risk environment, because as an APRA regulated entity, they don't want you to go out of business. They want you to kind of, well, how can you guys afford to be cheaper than that? So fees will come down as well, and with this new capital coming in, we'll have multiple investment options and lower fees as well. So we're very excited about that. It's very shortly away. So,
okay, let's go over here. Yes, you. Nope. Far side with a tie. There's not many. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing with us. Very, very much appreciated. The reading some of your email to your customer data just echoing what you said just now on the younger group of customer that you are getting. Can you share with us your thoughts on how to engage a different segment of the customer base, which might have a higher average balances that might that also like your concept of superannuation as well? Like a wider range of customers.
I think we're just concentrating on young people and trying to build a set of tools and products that are helpful to them. So that's
define young. Yeah. And from your side.
That's true. So our customer base is from sort of 20 to about 38 is our customers. So folks who have call it 20 to 30 years in their career still to go. I think that's what we want to concentrate on, and we're really, and that's more than a full-time job and getting that right. if you're in your 50s or beyond, you probably shouldn't look at us because we're not really trying to build a product for you. I think that's the other hard thing that super funds have had to do is that they've tried to, how do you build product and market to two different groups of people who have very different needs? You know, someone who's just about to enter retirement is very, very different to a 20-year-old. But if you go to a website of a large super fund, they're trying to, they're trying to appeal to both folks, and that's hard to do. You know, there's this meme that I used to say that you go to a super fun website and there would be a old gentleman with his wife on a park bench, you know, relaxing. A 20-year-old goes, oh man, is that my dad? I don't want to go here. You know, it doesn't make sense. So,
James, do you have a question?
Yep. Yeah. And then, I just have a question. You mentioned briefly about investing in private companies. I just wondering if you can talk a bit more about that and how that works.
Yeah, well, it's hard to talk about now because we're right in the thick of structuring it. But I think the ethos behind it is again that, you know, what's the best way to build wealth over the next 30 years? It's probably being invested in businesses, right? And then it's just a question of what businesses. Now, what's historically been done in superannuation is you have a blend between public and private businesses. And within the private realm, you'll find some way to mechanize that. And that can be through private equity, or it can be through venture capital, or it can be direct positions as well. And if you unpick what other super funds are doing, they're actually doing all those things, even direct positions. And so what we want to do is just focus on the most wonderful new companies being created. And usually what happens is, you know, the most wonderful companies in the world, they sort of start in VC and then they graduate out into public markets. If you look at the S&P 500 post 1970, it was something like 80% of the companies on there were all VC backed. So it generally makes sense to kind of start fishing around there and finding investments.
Hey, Jennifer?
Yeah, I'm just curious about 20 to 30-year-olds even thinking or caring about superannuation. So what percentage of your base have you had to, like, educate and drag them along and say, you need to worry about this versus ones that are actively thinking about this and are finding it?
I'm so glad you asked this question because I had a stat that I really wanted to say today and now I get to say it. Like 100% of our customers, you have to drag them on and educate them. And that's part of the fun of what we're doing is helping people understand that. That's not the stat, by the way. 100% is a terrible stat. A few months ago, I was doing a lot of research into the top five super funds. I won't name which one it is because I don't want to do that. Historically, what happens is when someone chooses a super fund, they don't actually choose it. They get defaulted in it because they don't make a choice as they get a new job. And one of the largest super funds out there, you know, over $50 billion in assets under management, they have six investment options. And the one investment option that you get defaulted into if you don't make a choice has something like 85% of their funds under management in that investment option. And their cheapest investment option, which is literally like, you know, about 2.5 times cheaper than the default option, has $120 million in it. That's like 10 basis points of total assets under management. Now, if you're a product manager and you had six products and one product was being used than less than 10 basis points of your customer base, you'd be like, well, what's going on? And it's also your cheapest product. You know, it's the index product. And you think, well, that's really sad. What does that mean? So if I was running that business, I would be on the phone to every single one of the customers who's in the default option saying, hey, you really need to think about this and you probably should make an active decision. It's okay to pick this default option, but actively choose it. And I don't think that stat's really well known at all. Because that certainly blew me away when I first learned it a few months ago.
Yes, Leah, isn't it? Leah.
You're in a category where you've got editors who spent tens of millions of dollars building brands over years and paying crazy amounts for cost of acquiring customers, and you tend not to. What insights can you share on how you've grown that base and how you've smashed up the traditional ways of acquiring customers in your sector?
Yeah. Within VC, I always saw wonderful products, right? But not many, not much wonderful marketing because it's actually really hard. There's so many wonderful products that die in the world because the market at best shrugs their shoulders. And what you learn when you're trying to scale a business is that marketing channels work differently for different businesses, and marketing channels decay over time. So I always like to think about the market as this kind of this really complex system that's happened. Like, the level of complexity in the market is extraordinary. If you think about any product in this room, about how it got to you today and how you were marketed to that product and found out about it, it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary level of complexity. And all those channels change over time. So, you know, there's this analogy that if you were marketed to on Facebook from the period of 2009 to 2011, it was really wonderful. You know, if Burberry reached out to you and said, hey, you know, do you want to buy a sweater? You're like, oh my God, Burberry's talking to me. But then 2 years later, you're like, oh, stop talking to me. You know, go away. It becomes annoying. And then Instagram becomes an interesting marketing channel. And if you look at all the large technology businesses that have successfully scaled, they haven't done it through paid marketing. You can't build a $100 million revenue line with paid marketing, because you just can't get the investment capital. You can't get $50 million to spend on marketing. It just never happens. So every successful technology business has built what's called an organic marketing channel over time. And what is an organic marketing channel? It's really a proxy for referrals. So you have to either you have to build something differentiated enough that people want to talk about it. Some products have more of a natural rate of referrals, you know, so no one's going to ask me where I got this sweater from, you know, because that's weird. Do you know what I mean? But if you come to my home as a friend and come into my living room and see that I have a new couch, first thing you're going to say to me is, where'd you get the new couch from, man? I'll say, oh, I got it from here. It's really, really cool. So that has a natural rate of referral. So that business has a better chance of being built online than a men's e-commerce fashion label. So the marketing side is so fascinating to think through and understand. But that's really our secret sauce, so we don't give that away.
Yeah. All right. There's still quite a few more questions. So are you guys all right if we roll through for another few minutes in the questions? We normally try and stop by 9, but let's go another 10 minutes. Yeah, over the back there. Yeah, you.
I love what you said about transparency and reporting, but I guess ultimately you're being judged on your return. Do you think your three guys are going to help inform BlackRock and PDA or everyone else?
I think first thing is we're having multiple investment options. So another type of customer we've learnt about is a customer who really does just want to own the index. They want to own the market, and they've, you know, learned through university or whatever about cap end pricing models and efficient market hypothesis, all sort of stuff. And so different people are going to have different views as to how to kind of mechanize wealth. We're very excited about our index product that's coming out. What I don't understand is, if you want to buy the index, well, what is the index? What is the market? Is the market, you know, the big four banks and a mining company, whereas the market, the world market, right? So if you look at, you know, trying to find a good index product online at the moment, it's actually really difficult to find what I think should just be the world index. You just buy the world index, you know, and if Aussie equities are only 3% of the world market, then you should have a pretty good reason why you should be overweight that market, you know. So I said earlier, think of the Brazilian guys coming to this country. It's like, why the hell do I want to own 10 times more Australian companies than I would if I just owned the index? So we're really thinking through investment options that are suitable for different folks. We're very confident that we're building a best-in-class investment infrastructure in our business. And the testament to that is the reporting and the transparency. So long as you can kind of each month go, why do I own Amazon? And why do I want to keep owning Amazon? And if you have if you can answer that question well, then I think you're moving in the right direction. So,
okay, let's go over here. Eve, and then.
So speaking of answering that question well, you invest in tech, which is great. But how do you choose which tech to invest in? Take the example of Lyft and Uber. How do you decide which one is going to be the one you're buying?
Yeah, this is a really good question. That is really where an investment professional comes in. So really what you're trying to understand is the level of differentiation and defensibility in both of those businesses, and taking a view. Now, sometimes what the view is, well, the whole sector is rising so rapidly that you can pretty much own the sector rather than an individual business in it, because the sector is so differentiated compared to the old sector, which is taxis. That is really where... That is why you're hiring a fund manager to make portfolio decisions for you, rather than doing it yourself, because they can help you think through what is a differentiated business. And if you really ask someone what makes a business differentiated and unpack, yeah, it's such a wonderful discussion to have because it's really hard to answer for most people. So,
yeah. If you're looking over the past 10 months, apart from raising more money, anything else we have done differently, a couple of things that you would have approached this money looking back?
I think that everything we do, we try and be differentiated in what we do, how we hire people, how we find information, how we do everything. I think it's such a wonderful lens to do a startup. It's just think through how when I make this decision, is it differentiated? And really, it doesn't have to be differentiated, but it forces you to think through, well, how do people usually do it and how can I do it differently? The hardest thing to do in a startup is to get information. I don't think people concentrate enough about where valuable data is found. It's usually in coffee conversations and not books. When I used to be a VC, I always used to sit down with founders and what you're really trying to understand is, you know that Warcraft game where people would kind of level up and they'd unlock achievements and stuff? You're really trying to understand what kind of wizard you're sitting in front of. So what are the two things that you're looking for? Well, one thing is an extraordinary network that's sitting behind them, right? So can they get access to hard to get information or hard to get resources? The second thing is their level of expertise. So do you believe that this person knows more about what they're talking about than anyone in the country? And probably the final thing is, do you believe that this person could get people who are way smarter than them to get behind this person and believe in their vision and want to work on it, you know, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night? So I don't know. I didn't really answer the question, but I love riffing off into things I really want to talk about.
All right, should we take one more? So this young man here.
In terms of like building a startup, obviously you hired quite a lot of people in the first year or so. How were those hiring decisions made? Like, did you get to the point where you actually analyzing each hire? What is the value that you're going to get out of this person? What is the way that they're going to kind of take off the purpose of doing that job? And what's the cost that we're willing to pay?
Yeah, I don't think there's one size that fits all for that. I think, you know, some people say as your diary fills up with something, you hire someone to remove it out of your diary. You know, so if you look at what my diary was over the course of the last 10 months, you know, it's changed. And as people have come into the business, I've been able to stop doing that. And then also you may just have a clear piece of expertise that you're looking for, so you go search out who's the best in the market at that. When I was at Airtree Ventures, we'd always try and be able to quickly identify, well, who are the five best engineers in the country? Who are the five best marketers in the country? Who are the five best, you know, people within whatever field it is? You're trying to, if you've built those networks over time, then you can go and have a conversation with Cameron Newman, who's, you know, he was the last 7 years at Campaign Monitor, started as a junior systems administrator and watched 200 people get hired, and then he ended up being the head of platform engineering there. And he's come across as our head of engineering. So, you know, such a wonderful person to have in the business. He can run circles around me any day of the week when it comes to anything on the technology side. But finding him was a clear piece of expertise that we're looking for. Same with Michelle on the risk and compliance side. We'd like, how many people in the market? There's probably five people in the market within risk that I'd want to talk to. So there's no easier answer for that, I don't think.
Any redundant times when you hired to fill a spot that you obviously needed at the time, but now the role is not sustainable going forward?
Sure. But then what you're hiring for is just really smart people. So, you know, there was a person, Arby in our team was our first hire. And he said, oh, you got to meet Jordan, who's very, very smart and capable. And Jordan's just done everything. And same with Arby, his title special projects, because he just does everything. He does all sorts of things, and his role changes each and every month. But if you're a smart person, you can figure it out. So, you know, if you're really, really smart, you can sit there on growthhackers.com and read it for, you know, a week straight and be at a talk shop with the best growth hackers in the market. So really, then what you're trying to do is find folks who are incredible learners and incredibly smart to do that. So,
okay, well, I think we'll maybe call it a day there. So, Paul, that was awesome. Thanks for the audience engaged questions. So, a round of applause. All right, just a couple of final words from me. Paul, I do have a gift for you, but I left it in my office. It's an Amazon Echo.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's pretty cool. So it's in my office. So that is good. So look, thank you again to the sponsors, Deloitte, Gilbert and Tobin, Macquarie. I should have also called out Amazon. We are in Amazon Web Services office. So thanks to me for doing that. No, so I do have a day job at Amazon. So I look after the startup sector. So I've got a pretty cool job to find the next spaceship, try and help them build on our platform. I think you are as well.
Absolutely.
And support them as they scale. So if anyone wants to talk to me about that, please do. Upcoming event, we have a founder. So we're moving the focus away from just pure angel dinners, which we used to do, to what we're calling founder dinners. We kind of don't want, you know, angel dinners implies quite one-dimensional if you come along to raise money and nothing else, whereas founder dinner is more about supporting the founders. Now, the reality is money raising will be part of that, but we want to try and open it up, make it a bit more democratic almost. So a few more people and more focus on the founders. So if you're a high-growth company and you fit the bill, go and sign up. Submissions, God, it's coming up, isn't it? 6 weeks, 7 weeks or so. So anything else, Shan, Faden? All right, look, thanks everyone. There's some more food to eat, so I'd encourage you to go and meet someone you haven't met before, do some networking. Thanks all for coming out this morning. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.